Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Judith Wellman. She's an award-winning historian and the founder of and principal investigator for Historical New York Research Associates. She's also the author of The Road to Seneca Falls, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the First Women's Rights Convention. Judith, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Grant. Glad to be here.
Well, let me start with your approach toward doing history, and then we can get into some of the specific topics that you've explored. Your book, The Road to Seneca Falls, and I'm paraphrasing some jacket material here, was widely noted for working upward from detailed documentary evidence to construct a tapestry of the causes for the Women's Rights Convention and the movement it founded. And several journals who reviewed your book called this the definitive work on the convention. So I was curious if you could tell me a bit more about how you approach the study of history in that book and more generally. What is this working upward all about?
I came of age as an historian in the early 70s, late 60s and early 70s, when social history was really moving forward to be a kind of flagship area of study for historians. And I did a dissertation looking at communities and how they promoted the abolitionist movement in upstate New York. So when I came to Oswego, I thought, what would be my next project? And I thought, I was teaching women's history. The biggest, most important document that came out of the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention, which was the first women's rights convention in the country, was a document called the Declaration of Sentiments. It was patterned after the Declaration of Independence, but instead of saying all men are created equal, it said all men and women are created equal. And there were 100 people who signed that declaration. And I was working with students. We went to Seneca Falls. We looked at that list and said, you know, we only know four names here, maybe three, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, Frederick Douglass, and maybe Martha Wright. Who the heck are the rest of these people? And it struck me very powerfully that the kinds of sources and methods that were emerging for social historians and community historians would be very useful in figuring out who those people were and thinking about what they did, why they did it, and why it became so nationally important. So that's one of the ways that I began working, and it's truly a magnificently rich resource to look at local materials and to do this kind of work from the bottom up. I'm not the only one who does that, but it's just quite a remarkable and generally unexplored whole body of source material. It's incredibly time-consuming, detailed, too, but it's really worth it. It's exciting. With students and myself, I always say, you have to ask, why was this important to people in the past, and how do you see it from their perspective? But when you pick a topic, you have to say, why is it important to me in the present, and why do I pick this topic? And they're two different questions, but they're both very important questions. So you try to connect those, the minutiae of all this data to larger themes and issues. And I think one of the reasons I focus on reform, women's rights, Underground Railroad, African-American rights, is that it goes to the essence of the Declaration of Independence and the idea that all people are created equal. And it deals with people who devoted their lives to that in the past, but it also challenges us in the present to think about what it means to us. And as citizens of the country and as citizens of the world, I think it's one of the most important issues. How do you respect yourself and other people and move forward in this world?
Well, I wanted to ask you about the way that you've done this as opposed to perhaps the way other historians might do this. You mentioned you're not the only person and the only historian that works in this way. But is there a common mistake that you think that some academic historians tend to make when they enter into local communities to research a particular topic?
An interesting question. I think a lot depends on your personality. You have to really be able to respect and understand the huge amount of work that's been going on at local levels by local ordinary people. And some of it is truly excellent. I think as academics, it's easy to dismiss citizen activism, but historical research is not rocket science. And it's almost as if you can be, you're born to it or you can be trained to do it, but it takes a particular personality who really cares and who really cares about doing it well and who isn't willing to back off from analyzing the evidence even when you don't like what it's saying. And I just find a lot of academic colleagues do that well. A lot of community historians do that very well. And so it's been my pleasure and honor to work with a huge variety of people who really care about these topics and who make amazing contributions.
And you were talking about the fact that when you were looking at the convention and the people who attended, that there were three or four names that were known and then a whole host of the others that folks didn't know very much about. And so I wanted to ask you, what were the main things that you revealed in your book about the convention that had been previously underappreciated or unknown?
Oh, that was really quite remarkable, and it took years to do this. I thought I was going to do a quantitative study when I did all this sophisticated analysis with the help of a lot of good people, and I did a lot of papers and talks, and then I sat down with a sabbatical, and I said, oh, good, I'll just put this all together, and it'll form itself into a book, and I sat down, and I just couldn't do it. And then I heard this woman, Elizabeth McClintock, was one of these historic characters, and she said to me, you know, you cannot tell this story the way you want to tell it with all these statistical and analytical things. If you're going to tell this story, you have to tell it in our words. You have to tell what we want people to hear. I said, okay, and I started all over and told it basically as a very traditional narrative, interweaving a lot of personal anecdotes and quotes from people in the past. So it was quite an interesting process for me. But what turned out to be the key and why people came, one reason was there was a whole legal component to this that Elizabeth Cady Stanton brought a good understanding to, and New York State had just passed a Married Women's Property Act, the first one in New York State, and she said, now that men have done this for us through the Assembly and the Senate, it's time that women took a stand and did this for themselves.
And that act was, just briefly, what?
It gave married women the right to own property, okay, which they had never had before. And that led to questions about if you can own property, that means you can be independent, then why can't you be voting? Mm-hmm. So that sort of led into that whole touchy discussion of voting. But the other two components were related to abolitionism. One of them, the largest group of people who came and signed that Declaration of Sentiments were people involved in political abolitionism and the emergence of the Free Soil Party. At the end of this, the Mexican War, the U.S. had to decide whether territories in the Southwest should be slave or free, and this political party was arguing they should be free. And then the other group was a group of Quakers who were Garrisonian abolitionists. They were non-political, but very holistic in their approach to reform and abolition, and they were really the main organizers besides Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and a huge number of them voted. And out of that work actually came a project I'm working on now to save the 1816 Quaker Meeting House in Farmington, New York, that was related to that group of Quakers that really people hadn't identified before.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Judith Wellman, a historian who studies the women's rights movement and the Underground Railroad in upstate New York. Well, I wanted to ask you a question moving sort of ahead to the present, thinking about women's rights. If we could think of Martin Luther King's long arc of the moral universe as it applies to women's rights, where do you think we are presently on that arc? How far are we still from justice?
Wow, as it applies to black rights, too, and to poverty, questions of poverty. It's not just one arc. I think it's a multiplicity of arcs, and it's not necessarily a rainbow arc. Some of it's pretty dark, and I think depending on where we are in the world, in the country, and which issue we're talking about, we're at different places on it. But I do think that's the conceptual framework to keep in mind. Where are we on that moral arc, and where are we going? Which direction are we going in?
And you mentioned the Underground Railroad, and you've done a lot of work on that, as well as women's rights movement. And you've done work on documenting sites that are part of the railroad. I wanted you to tell me a little bit about that work, and perhaps as a vehicle to do that, I wanted to know whether you've found in your work that there are certain stereotypes about the railroad that we have today that are off the mark, because we hear a lot about the railroad here up in this area.
Yes, we do, and almost anyone in any community can tell you this or that house was a house on the Underground Railroad, and you say, well, why? And they say, well, because it had a tunnel going down to the river. Almost always that tunnel's been closed up and no one's ever seen it. But that's sort of the level of documentation that a lot of people sort of think about. And there are lots of stereotypes that you need to have a tunnel in a house, or that people use quilts. Neither of those is true. One of the biggest stereotypes is that we can't ever find out anything about it because it was a secret movement. And what's astounding to me is if you start reading the newspapers, looking at census reports and picking out the African Americans who said, yes, I was born in Maryland, Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, Kentucky, Tennessee, and I've lived here for 3 years. And you think, well, why did they come to Syracuse from the South? And so that's a group of people that most likely actually escaped. And that challenges another stereotype, which is that everyone went to Canada. Mm-hmm. Thousands of people settled in Syracuse, Central, Western, upstate New York, and in the North. In fact, Syracuse by the 1850s was known as the Canada of the North or a free city. Mm-hmm. And people were saying, you will never take back anyone from this community to slavery again. As you look at it, as with so many other general topics, you begin to see it's much more complex, much more interesting, and the stories are ones that you just can't make up. These are real stories that people really lived, and they're telling them often in their own words in memoirs, or people are repeating them in newspapers, or they're writing diary notes, and they're just all kinds of evidence. And certainly we never will know anything. I mean, I don't write down what I eat for breakfast, so. But we're beginning to get a real sense of the detailed nature of these stories and these people who really voted with their feet and devoted their lives to this movement.
Well, Judith, you mentioned just a couple minutes ago the stories that you've uncovered on this search to learn more about the Underground Railroad. Are there one or two that stand out for you that you could tell me about?
Oh, there are so many, it's hard to pick. But Syracuse was so important in the Underground Railroad because it was at a crossroads of a major east-west migration route with the Genesee a turnpike and the canal and the New York Central Railroad, and people coming up through the Finger Lakes north and south, so people would cross here. And by the 1850s, a whole group of local people, white and black, combined to raise money, find clothes, find transportation, find jobs, find housing for people. But those who were passing through mainly went to the home of Reverend Germaine Logan and Caroline Logan, on East Genesee Street, and they actually built an apartment on their house. And the whole pattern shifts when the New York Central Railroad combines in 1853 to make a direct east-west route. It didn't have to stop. And the Logan House, was just a couple blocks from the railroad. So you find people like Isaac Williams, who wrote a very detailed memoir, and he said, we stayed for 3 days with the Logans, and then Reverend Logan took us to the train station, and he talked directly to the conductor, and he said, get these people across the river, be sure they're safe. So instead of the stories we hear about people hiding in the woods or crossing the creeks or being chased by bloodhounds, a lot of people from Syracuse, and actually they're coming right up from New York City doing this, they just get on the train with tickets provided by local managers of the New York Central Railroad, and they ride straight to Canada to Niagara Falls. They go right across the suspension bridge, and they don't get off until they get to Ontario. So it's quite a remarkable shift from earlier periods where people were using much more foot and wagons. One story that comes to mind deals with Mexico, New York. The Star Clark Tin Shop is now a site on the National Register. It received a major New York State grant for restoration. It was not at all looked like what it originally looked like. So it confronted this issue of historic importance when you get on the National Register versus issues of integrity and architectural importance. And we made the argument successfully there that because this is so historically important, a man named George detailed his coming up from Maryland and coming through Pennsylvania and getting caught and having to break free and come up through Binghamton and then Syracuse, and then he went to Mexico. And the story was absolutely nailed and so important, and yet the building lacked a lot of details that might have made it appealing to people who are interested in architectural beauty. But we said, you know, all these things that have been changed in the building, if it's restored, will be put back. And sure enough, it is now a restored building. So that is, I think, one example of confronting the definition of what makes a building historic. And the Preservation League of New York State has been absolutely wonderful in funding. I think they're on their fifth or sixth statewide survey that I've done with local people in every place, identifying just dozens of these sites relating to the Underground Railroad, abolitionism, and African-American life.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is the historian, Judith Wellman. Well, there's one question I really wanted to put to you, and it's about just this area. I mean, if you think about this area, and you can think about the Haudenosaunee and the Iroquois Confederacy early on, and then the women's rights movement and the Underground Railroad, is there something about this place which creates and fosters important political moments and movements? And also, what happened to us?
Oh, that last one's a good question. There was something very important, and it was that, as you know, this whole region was controlled by Haudenosaunee people before the American Revolution. After the Revolution, dominant culture Europeans saw this wonderfully productive, rich land and said, we have to go. And people came from different culture hars, Europeans. New England was a major one, coming directly west, southeastern Pennsylvania, Maryland, coming up through the Finger Lakes, crossing right here. People coming from eastern New York along the Hudson River, kind of Anglo or Dutch background. People coming then from Europe, like Germans, Irish. And they're moving into this area with extreme rapidity. This whole Turnpike Canal Railroad just brought people right here. And they have to settle next to each other, and they have to decide, how are we going to form a community in the context of this larger new American nation where all people are created equal and respect each other? And so they begin to dialogue. They're forced to dialogue about essential issues of what is a community, what does it mean to be an American. And they're all coming in quickly, so there isn't a kind of matrix into which they fit that's already there. And I think it creates a really combustible kind of grassroots exploration.
A creative tension.
Yeah, like. Absolutely. Yeah. The whole printing revolution contributed to it, because instead of the old flatbed presses in the early 1830s, you could run stuff off with rotary presses, which made it much cheaper, much faster, so people get to read stuff. And they really are connected. They know very well what's going on in Albany and Washington, D.C. You may have heard the term the burned-over district, which... That's part of this whole ferment of reform, as Alice Felt Tyler called it, as people were burned over by fires of revivalism and reform. And then it's kind of like Southern California in the 1960s. I think whenever there's a place where people from different backgrounds rush into quickly, there is this kind of debate about essential questions and a huge amount of energy that explodes, really, and affects the whole country. This is a nationally important area in the pre-Civil War period.
And it sounds like maybe lessons to take in thinking about present day. Well, very quickly, before we get to the three questions at the end, I wanted also to ask you, if someone who's listening to the program wants to go and do history locally, study history, what are some of the best kinds of tools that would be available to them?
Oh, my goodness. Get on Google and put in whatever you're interested in. Mm-hmm. There is just a huge amount of information. If you're interested in things like the Underground Railroad, there's a whole series at Doc South at the University of North Carolina of memoirs that are just available, searchable everywhere. All the kinds of census records. I always start by looking at every African American in any community, and you just get hundreds of people, like 400 or 500 in the Syracuse and Onondaga County area in this period. So it's really easy to do, and it's especially good for high school students, college students, local historians, or academic historians, college students. It's just really exciting because you can make a contribution that no one has ever discovered before to whatever topic you're looking at. So it's very powerful.
And now the three questions. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
You know, I knew you were going to ask that. I often sign my emails moving right along, and I suppose that's as good a one as any. Hope it's the right direction.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I think one of my worst traits, I probably have several, is taking on more than I can handle easily. So life is a challenge.
And then finally, what achievement in your creative or professional life so far has surprised you the most?
I think one thing that surprised me so much in this recent research I've done has been the extent to which there is really, really good documentation about the Underground Railroad. I mean, I knew there was a lot, but some of these stories are just profoundly moving. And I just say to people, you never could make this up, but here it is. It's, you know, written by the person at the time they were involved, and it's like primary source evidence of the absolutely best kind, and people constantly tell me we can't ever find out anything, and I say, well, you just got to look.
That was Judith Wellman, author of The Road to Seneca Falls, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and the First Women's Rights Movement. Judith, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
Support comes from the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University, dedicated to the study and practice of citizenship, leadership, and public governance. Information at maxwell.syr.edu.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher. Associate producers include Bethany Wallowender and Kelly Coleman, with recording engineer Tom Fazio. Learn more about the Campbell Conversations by visiting our website, wrvo.org.